Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Gasoline prices are in a free fall all over the country, with some states landing under $2 a gallon. While this is a boom for consumers and a lot of businesses, businesses in the oil industry could really be struggling. Most of these businesses are very highly leveraged, and they have high debt loads, and so having any prolonged lower prices can really hurt them. Today, we are going to be welcoming Ronz Dixon, who's the founder of Shale Experts. He is going to give us insight into what's really going on in this industry. Is it just pure market conditions, or is there something more geopolitical going on with Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia? I mean, we know that there's a lot of turmoil right now, and there's a lot of problems. So is it related to that, or is it just market conditions? Well, we won't obviously have all the answers, but he will give you really good insight into what the market conditions are right now and what some of the possibilities are or could be for the geopolitical situation. So it's super interesting. But before we get into that, I'm going to be talking to Tech Barn CEO and founder John Upgren, and he's going to be explaining to us what data centered marketing is and how your company can use this to dramatically do good things for your company and really improve your bottom line. This guy is smart. He has an engineering degree from MIT, and I know he's taken a lot of, I don't know if he has his MBA. I think he does, but I know he's taken a lot of business coursework through the Sloan School as well. But the other thing is he was the top salesperson at Next, which was Steve Jobs' company before he went back to Apple. So he's just a bright guy, and I'm going to eventually or pretty soon have him back for a full interview. But for now, he's going to do our Gear Up for 2015 segment, and I think this is a must-listen-to segment. But before I get into all of that, I am going to discuss my solar project that I have going on. We are still in the midst of that, and my equipment is ordered, and I'm getting really excited. But I learned today that Dakota Electric, which is my local utility company, has just added an incentive. Before that, I didn't have any incentive from the energy, you know, my utility company. Most people do have incentives, but they are now adding incentives. So I'm going to be saving another 12 to 15% on my project, which will be paid over the next 10 years. And then I also got confirmation, which I knew this before, but I wanted to get absolute confirmation based on my taxes, that I will be able to write off the interest on my loan for the solar project. So since my loan is going to be pretty close to my loan monthly payment, it's going to be really pretty close to what my monthly payment is for the electric bill that's going away. And now that I can write most of that off because it's interest, I'm really going to be saving money. And this is all on top of the 30% tax credit. So if you have not gotten your bid yet, make sure you call Chris Elquist and get hold of him and talk to True North Solar. Actually, first, go to their website at truenorthsolar.com, TRUNorthSolar.com, and get a quote from them today. You'll learn how much you can save your family and how much better it is financially for you. And if you get your quote, you can get a $50 free restaurant card. So you can't lose. You'll be educated. You'll get a free card, and you'll learn all about your solar projects. Now we're going to get started and talk to John Upgren from Tech Barn. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sarah. It's great to be here.
Okay, we're going to dive right in. What does your company, Tech Barn, do?
Well, we are in the space of marketing that's called executional services. And what that means is that we perform and build systems that help marketers actually do stuff. And when we talk about doing things, we mean everything from answering phones, taking orders for literature and samples online through storefronts, packing and shipping products, delivering gifts and rewards and checks for consumers when they buy products and then submit proof of purchase.
So you take over order processing and a lot of the upfront marketing customer service stuff for companies.
Right. Yes, and another way to say that is we're the arms and legs companies, so that when you put a marketing campaign in market to sell products, a lot of times part of that involves customers calling in and identifying themselves that they're interested in buying. And from that point, a lot of things happen, things like sending emails, making phone calls to the customer, referring a dealer, sending a brochure, sending product samples, and those take people and systems.
So you would be great for somebody who has a product and really likes to sell it, but just doesn't want to do the rest of it.
Well, yes. In fact, a lot of our clients are actually what we call blind distribution clients. And what that means is that they don't really know who buys their product because the product is distributed and sold through either a dealership or installers in the case of plumbing or sinks, or they're sold even at retail, and they don't really have an idea of who the buyer is. So there's a lot of work that goes into supporting the sale that involves everything from a sample to a brochure to a phone call to a dealer referral, and we handle that work.
Well, doesn't that make them nervous not to know who their buyers are? So do you help them figure out who their customers actually are?
Yes, we do, and yes. It does make them very nervous. And it's interesting because we have a client base that's probably 60-70% of our clients are in the home shelter category, which are products for your home. That would be anything from kitchen cabinets to windows, countertops, plumbing fixtures, toilets, bathtubs, that kind of thing, and then kitchen fixtures like sinks. And for a long time, they've really had very little understanding of who actually buys their products. One of our points of differentiation is, in addition to doing all the arms and legs stuff, we actually put all of this into a single database, and we call this data-centered marketing. And the point of that is we can begin to do backside analysis of all the purchase data, of all the prospect data, and then using big data analytics with some partnerships we have with some of the large data firms, we actually build purchase profiles, and we can tell you how likely a person is to buy your product based on data we collect.
Yeah, and that's the future of marketing, or it's not even the future, it's now. It's the future of business management. But these companies that don't know who their buyers were and don't, you know, kind of flying blind, they must just love you because suddenly now, I have control. And business managers need that control just to feel secure, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. I know you're right, but one of the challenges we have in, and actually a lot of companies in analytics have, is their marketing is still filled with people who think that sort of gut feel is good enough. And we find that actually the CFOs, the finance people, and the sales people actually like us a lot because we can really deliver ROI on all the market spend against the sales activity.
Well, I can't imagine any salesperson who is worth anything not liking somebody that can help their sales. I mean, because sales, I've done a lot of sales, and sales is a pain in the butt. And if you can help, let's face it, right? How many doors do you get slammed in your face before you make a sale? And that's just the reality of sales, right? And so if you can keep less doors slamming in your face because you're not even going to those people that aren't likely to buy, but you're increasing the doors that are going to be more likely to be open. It's just like getting to your niche market. Here's your niche.
Exactly right. No, you're exactly right. But here's the dilemma,
especially
in larger companies. If you go to the chief marketing officer and you say, we've done the research on your company and the people that buy your products, and we know your dealer channel, and we know your competitive set and all that kind of thing, and putting $4 million into your website is a waste of money, they don't know what to do with that, because what that really means is that the marketing budget is going to shrink, and very few people will make rational decisions to say, my domain should get smaller. Because you can make the argument that, and you just did, that if we transfer some of that money over into the pre-sale management so that we do a better job of only identifying very likely customers and then hand those to the sales team, that might cost a lot than $4 million into a website. But that budget isn't the marketing budget.
Well, they're nervous because they're so used to just going after blanketing everybody. They're so used blanketing the numbers, and then they, it's all about just getting out there in the numbers, all about just blanketing the market. Well, no, not really.
Right. Yeah. And of course, you mentioned this whole focus on and really integrating data analytics into the market side. If you think about it, to this day, nearly all of the data and all of the measurement metrics used by marketing are still impression-based, or they're related to impression-based. I can't tell you how many times we've been in meetings where a person will say, well, we had 1.4 million leads last month. And we look at them like, you're kidding us. You had 1.5 million people say they want to buy the product? Oh, no, no, no. That's the number of people that visited the website. We call those leads. And so there's a big difference in, if you talk sales and marketing, it's almost a little Mars and Venus, because we have allowed marketing people to talk about leads as people just either accidentally or intentionally finding your website. That's a lead.
Browsers are leads.
Right, exactly. Unique visits are leads. Page views are leads. Not really. They're not leads. They're not leads. They're people that are perhaps they're in planning stages. You might have typed in Windows and you're interested in Windows for your house, but you end up on Microsoft's site. So there are a lot of reasons why that's just the wrong thing to do. But there is some tension between the sales and marketing side when it comes down to analytics, because analytics puts everybody on the spot. And salespeople are used to that. That's how you grade sales. How did you do? Marketing people have a little bit different responsibility because they still have to build brand. There has to be brand awareness. They have to take care of the brand and steward it. And a lot of times that's not directly related to ROI.
Interesting. So the marketing people are still out there kind of pie in the sky, and they need to be creating brand, right? Brand is a whole other thing. And creating brand gives you a higher demand for your product, but there's a difference between the niche marketing. I guess niche marketing really is kind of, you know, the new deal. I teach a class at the Carlson School, and you know, we teach niche marketing. How do you get in there and get niche market? Social media, all that stuff is about niche marketing now, because you can you can go to your customer, or they can come to you. You can go to them. You create, it's a whole different ball game. But
that's right.
You know, data-centered management, data-centered marketing. What you're telling me is that some of the people are still in the dark ages when it comes to just understanding data.
I think most of the world is still in the dark ages understanding data.
See, we were way ahead of our time back in the day when we worked together.
Well, and here's one that'll really blow you away. If you think about, and this is true of Tech Barn, because we again handle the shelter products. The sense that everyone is in the market to buy a Blanco sink, an Anderson window, jacuzzi spa, a Toto toilet or lavatory for their bathrooms is not an accurate market, because they are premium products. These are all category leaders. And the average purchase age is probably in the 55 to 62 years old. That doesn't mean people like you and me won't buy those products, but means the average age is substantially higher. You can actually view their market as a niche.
Yeah.
Because it only makes up maybe 40 million of the U.S. population. And if you really think about how to market even the high-end brand luxury products for the home, that's a niche market. But people don't think of it that way. They think of it as a mass market.
Oh, geez. High-end luxury goods is definitely a niche market.
Yes, it is. And it also means it's a lot easier, because now we get into the little less comfortable part of the conversation, which is essentially a number of our clients are 1% companies. They sell products to the 1%. And if you stop and think about the 1% being approximately 10 million households, 5 million households in the United States, and the reason it's a little high, there's 140 approximately million households, but the 10 million is a fair amount of them have more than one household. So if you think about that as that's your target, that's a dramatic niche to go after, and it takes very focused marketing to do it. And a lot of the companies haven't really come to what's the right way to say it? Their self-awareness of that hasn't really shown up in the way they market.
So you provide a great service to these people, because you really help them understand, okay, how do we get your dollars focused? Let's get your dollars focused. We'll provide a lot of the legwork for you from an operational standpoint. We'll get your dollars really focused, and we'll show you who your customers are, because we'll provide a whole data marketing approach that you probably haven't seen before, or if you have, it's been in more of the sophisticated kind of areas.
That's exactly right. The interesting thing is our approach is a little different, though. We don't come in at the top and say, here are the five things you should do. We come in what I call at the middle, and we say, first of all, we need to have all the data about your current selling infrastructure. You know, where are your dealers? Who are the dealers that have what displays? You know, how do you communicate where people can go? What time are those dealers available for people to stop and visit? How does your website collect leads? Those are the basics of beginning the process of gathering things. Then once we've got that, we then layer over the top the analytic portion that says dealers in the Northeast get twice the rewards money, that is rebate checks, and they're only selling 5% more than dealers in the West. And so the sales team and the marketing team go, well, we need to rebalance our program.
Well, yeah, we either need to target them more, or we need to figure out why are they not buying more. I mean, you just having the data can allow you to be smart.
Right. We just finished. We did a year-end review with one of our clients about 2 weeks ago, and we do a rewards program, which is essentially if a sales associate at a dealer, because remember the dealers are not exclusive in most of our situations, so they have the option to sell any product, any particular sink, any particular window that they carry. They're really under no loyalty per se. So what oftentimes the manufacturer will write a check for $25 if they sell one of their products. This is a rebate or sales spiff program, and they're very common in all throughout retail as well for high-end products. Well, we showed him the results of the rewards program. He goes, 50% of my payout is going to 25 people, and I have over 2,000 salespeople. So clearly the program...
The program
is not working.
That's like an executive's nightmare. You know, you can look at it either way. You can go, oh, my God, I'm an idiot, and I need to figure this out. Or you can go, oh, I could save a whole bunch of money.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they say. And we say, yeah, you know, now let's talk about why. You know, is the reward too low? He goes, no, it's not too low. He goes, I've been doing this forever. I know exactly what's going on. People don't care. And it's really true that one of the
that's issues so funny that, though, because all of us have run into something like that in business. That's just so hilarious. Keep going.
Yeah. So he said, no, people don't care. He said, you know, one of the great dilemmas when you don't control the distribution, and the only time a company truly controls its distribution is through direct sales.
Exactly. Because if you don't know who your customer is, you can't control all that.
No, you can't. And so when you're in a non-exclusive environment, the people that tend to do well take orders. They're really good at figuring out when someone walks in the showroom who's buying and who isn't, and they go for the clothes and take an order. And so they don't tend to worry too much about actually selling a particular product. And then when you have sophisticated companies that have different product lines with differing levels of margin, it's really important for them to try and get the high-end margin products sold. Now, the dealer makes more, the manufacturer makes more, and many times the consumer is happier because consumers will always reach for luxury if they feel they can.
Well, if they can, because they want the value, right?
Yes, exactly right. So it's very difficult when you're the manufacturer to come up with programs that actually have a direct impact on the salesperson in the dealership. And so throwing money out there is what the industry as a whole has done a lot of without a lot of measurement. So now we have online systems. They can log in. They can look at the top salespeople. They can look at the inventory of samples. They can find out which displays are at which dealer. And all that's part of what we call data-centered marketing.
You know what? I got to have you back for a whole show because you're the MIT guy. I know you graduated from MIT. What business? You got an MBA from MIT, right?
No, I have a degree in engineering from MIT, but the program
engineering from MIT. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought it was the MBA from MIT. Keep going.
Yeah, well, but the program I was in the Department of Civil Engineering, and so we had coursework. We could take pretty much any courses we want. So I took courses in the Media Lab at MIT, and in the Sloan School of Business and engineering. So
okay.
I was in all of them.
Because I know you as a business guy, but I know you're a smart engineering person. The other thing, when I first met you, you were the top salesperson at Next Computer, which was Steve Jobs' baby back in the day.
Yes.
And so I know you have extensive knowledge of that industry as well, and just data marketing data-centered approaches, marketing from all your background there. I need to have you back to talk about it.
Okay.
That would be great. And businesses, people should talk to you because you have a unique approach. Anybody who really understands data-centered management understands the power of that. And if anybody's inkling with that, they should really talk to you because there is so much power and you have such a competitive advantage if you look at things like that.
Yeah, and you know what really is frightening about this analytics side is we have a client we've been working with now for about 3 years, 4 years, and we have built a statistical regression model that takes a customer, a prospect record, so it's a lead that comes off the website or through their call center off of DirecTV. It hits our server, we fix the address up, verify the phone number, run it through our scoring model, and send it back with a lead score. And we do that in less than 3 seconds. So it's real time, and you can actually integrate this into the call center. And then over time, we study, you know, they use a 10-to-1. You can use 3-star, 2-star, platinum, gold, whatever, but they use 10-to-1. So a 10 is a high-quality lead, a 1 is a low-quality lead. And over the three and a half years we've been doing this, it takes 17 tens to get one member to join, and it takes 43 ones to get a member to join.
Yeah, there's a big difference. So
it's a huge difference.
Have you analyzed your investment payback?
Yeah, so that and this is the point of me telling you the story. So that service cost them about 25 cents a name. So if you think about the margin that they're getting off of that 25 cents, it's phenomenal. Now, the reason that I can't ROI this directly is I don't know what their margin numbers are for their product, but their product price point is between $3,500 and $5,500.
If they can hand cherry pick out the tens and pay 25 cents a piece for them, that's incredible.
Yeah, and then here's the trick, and this is the challenge to businesses. It's a challenge to marketers, too. Once we tell you that, it isn't just that we give you the 10 lead, because that's important lead and that should be followed up with. It's how are you changing your marketing to generate more 10s and less 1s. And we actually grade out all of their radio, web, and DirecTV campaigns. So they can instantly look at the campaign and go, my average lead score off of this late night remnant DirecTV is 4.1.
So they're starting to see those numbers go up as your marketing gets better. And so you're showing them, look at your marketing's better. You're saving money on your advertising and your marketing. You're building brand awareness with the client base you want. And your cost per lead is going down. And now you know who your buyers are and you're in control.
And you're only paying me 25 cents.
I get it. I get this whole data set. I get what you're doing. I just, I think the people should talk to you. And if you have, I don't even know what to say. Just give them a call. What is your phone number so people can get a hold of you and your sales team to learn more about this?
Sure. They can find us on the web at techbarn.com. That's tech as in technology, barn as in farm. The reason it's called Tech Barn is when I was at Next, and I was working in Minnesota, all the California tech guys said there's nothing but cows out in Minnesota, so why would you live there? So it's called Tech Barn, and the phone number is 651-275-8300.
And you work nationally, though, right? You work with anybody.
Oh, yeah. We actually, you know, we only have one or two clients in Minnesota. Most of our clients are national.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, well, good. Well, thank you so much, John, and I'm definitely going to get you set up for a whole interview. I hope you don't mind.
I don't mind at all. It'll be a lot of fun.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a great day.
You too.
Well, that was kind of a fun interview. I worked with them back in the day when, gosh, I was in my mid-20s when I worked with them and I met them, and that was a lot of fun. I worked at a Baby Bell company that actually was one of the few places in the country, well, telecom, that had Next computers all set up, and we were so far ahead of everything, and we had a data-centered approach that we used, and it's just amazing what that can do. We automated our whole department, and it's pretty amazing, and he's a smart guy, and I think you would get a lot out of it if you talked to him. If you're in an area where you're just feel like you're clueless and you really need help, or if you just know that you need to do a data center approach, I would really recommend calling them, because I think you could be, I think you would be surprised at how much that can help you. Okay, so we're going to move on and we're going to talk to Ronz Dixon, and he's going to educate us on the oil industry.
Hello, Ronz. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to talk to you specifically because the energy industry, shale oil, is at an all-time low, or at least it's not all-time, because obviously 100 years ago it was less, but it's at a low right now, and it doesn't look like it's going to be going anywhere north very soon. In fact, people are saying it's going to go lower. And so I wanted to get your indication of what was going on in the oil industry and also talk to you about the Middle East and Russia and how that all plays into it. But before we get into all that stuff, will you talk a little bit about yourself and what your company does?
So we are shale experts, and what we're a small boutique firm that really tries to provide context to big majors, the super majors, the small independents, large independents, the Conocos, the BPs, and the service and supply business. So what we try to do is we try to provide some sort of context on how to understand and interpret activities in the industry, specifically relating to shale and what that's doing. So we have a website, shaleexperts.com, and on this site we cover on a daily basis unconventional activities. So, you know, we'll use the word interchangeably, shale and unconventionals. So that's really what we do. We provide.
What would be unconventionals besides shale?
Well, you've got, so if you take a step back, you look at, you know, tight sand is not a shale. You know, shale is a type of, if you kind of go back, so tight sand is not a shale. People often say, the Mississippi Lime, which is bordering off.
So you're just grouping all the different types of stones and geology
together. All the different types of formations.
So you're not talking solar or something. You're just talking about all the different geological formations.
Exactly. That yields petroleum. That's really how we want to group it.
Okay.
So we provide intelligence into the industry on how to better understand the different activities and how to predict the activities as well, too.
And so you would be talking, you talk to consulting companies, you talk to big banks, small banks, you talk to investment firms, you talk to the companies in the oil industry, and you talk to a gamut of different people and educate them on what's going on in the industry at large, right? And how, and give them information so they know kind of where to invest and what to do.
Yeah, so we've got a wide cross-section of clients and customers, from financial firms all the way down to service and supply, E&P companies. So anybody that really wants to understand specifically what's going on in oil and gas, we talk to them. So we've got a unique position, because if you kind of look at, if you take a step back and look at the value chain, it really starts with the availability of capital, which is capital providers. They provide capital for two sections of the industry. One, which is E&P companies, to be able to acquire land and further explore. I'm really simplifying, but I'm trying to give a broader feel. They
sure.
also provide capital for the service supply companies to develop new technologies and be able to apply those technologies to E&P's asset that they've acquired through land and so forth. So we talk to the entire value chain. So we have a very unique insight into the industry because we get to see and hear what everybody else is thinking as it pertains to their unique perspective in the business.
Oh, and that's because you're involved with a lot of the capital investments?
It's because we're involved with all the different parts. We're involved with people that lend money into the industry, so whether it's through private equity or through banks. We're involved with E&P companies, so they're talking about the availability of capital on the accessibility, how easy it is to access that capital. We're talking with civil supply firms, which are concerned about E&P's access to capital and their debt levels. And we're talking with, so we talk to all these different facets of the business, which is very.
It's like an upward, it's an upward spiral of understanding, because everybody wants to know what's going on. So the more people you talk to, the more you know what's going on, and you're talking to all the different areas of the business.
That's what we do.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Well, just a little background on what's going on right now. I just pulled a thing showing what the prices are. And as of today, which is Tuesday, what is it? The 8th, the 9th. Oh, it's the 9th of December already. It's at $63 a bale right now. Mm-hmm. And I've been reading that some people think it's going to go down to as much as $43 a bale by second quarter 2015. What do you think as far as the prices? What do you think that's going to?
So it's interesting. You know, one of the things my dad told me a long time ago, he said economists predicted 3 of the last 30 recessions. So I take that, you know, I take all these different predictions with a grain of salt. Here's what I do know.
Well, that's fair.
So here's what I
can appreciate.
What I do know is we did a study last year, last November, that specifically, it was a very interesting study because it came to us from a refinery. So the refinery is what processes crude, right, to make gasoline and different distillates. So they wanted to better understand. They were planning on expansion. So we did a study, and here's what we found out. What we found out was that production in the U.S. was rising at a rapid pace. So that's what we found out. So we looked at two things. When you have rising production.
I have numbers that says that North Dakota in the last 5 years has three times as much oil production, and Texas has five times. I mean, that's huge.
Absolutely. But what I was trying to do is to, you know, I'm connecting the dots so that your listeners can
sure. I just had to interject how much it's rising with just a couple of stats, but keep going.
It's grown significantly, but what has happened as a result is, let's say crude, right? Let's say we're going to break crude into two forms. We're going to break crude into heavy crude and light crude. That's very, very important to understand. So what has grown in this country is we call it light sweet. So light sweet crude has grown. And I'll kind of look at some of the numbers you pointed out. So 5 years ago, we were importing in this country about 9 million barrels per day. Now, at the end of this year, we're projected to get that down to 6.5 million barrels. That's 2.5 million barrels.
30% less.
Absolutely. That amount of crude has to find a new market. So keep that caveat. I'm going to get back to why, you know, prices are where they are right now. So what has happened is there's a tremendous amount of growth of crude in this country, which means crude we used to import has to find a new market. So if your international market, China hasn't grown at the rapid pace that people thought it would, you have issues in Japan and in Europe. Europe is in a complete mess.
Yes.
So you haven't had the growth in demand that we thought we were going to have to absorb that 2.5 million barrels. So what typically happens? You have downward pressure on the price. So that's one thing that has pushed price down. Now, the other thing is this. People tend to forget that, because my background is in financial markets, people tend to forget that you have players in this market that have an incentive to drive prices down.
Well, yeah, there's players that want it down. There's players that want it up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's players that want the price down, and they have also contributed. And then the third one is people talk all the time about OPEC is losing its power. We believe that OPEC's goal from day one has always been to, in their words, to normalize prices to in the international markets. We still believe that OPEC / Saudi Arabia still wields that power. And we saw that when they met November 27th. What happened? They refused to cut production and prices cratered. So those are the three big things that we see that have pushed the price down.
But why does OPEC want to keep the prices low? I mean, because they're not reducing their supply.
No, and that's a very, very, very important question. And the answer will depend on who you ask. If you ask someone whose interest is tied to higher oil prices, they'll tell you, so we believe two reasons, right? We believe that for years, OPEC has sat, and when I say OPEC, I'm really talking about Saudi Arabia here.
Yeah, because they have the most power, right?
Exactly. They've sat and watched growth in production, specifically from the U.S. and Canada. We call that high oil price growth, meaning $90 barrel and upwards.
Yep.
So they've sat back and they've seen the growth in the U.S. production and growth in Canada, and they're losing market share. If you think about the numbers we talked about earlier, right? Our imports have gone from 9 million barrels to the end of this year, it would be 6.5 million barrels. If you take that downward trajectory and multiply that by another year, and then now we're down to 5 million barrels. Saudi Arabia sends 1.5 million barrels to the U.S. So what happens? It means that crude that they send to the U.S. starts to get pushed out of the market.
Yeah, so they're worried because they're worried because we're the largest producer of oil right now, right?
We're getting pretty close. I think at the end of this year we'll get pretty close.
So the headlines weren't quite. Everybody exaggerates in headlines, so it wasn't quite right. We're getting close to being the largest producer.
We're getting close to yes. We're not there yet. We're not there yet.
Saudi Arabia. Who's ahead of us? Russia.
Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia's ahead of us, and then we'd be next, and then who's after us?
Russia.
Russia. Okay, so,
yeah.
But with OPEC keep or Saudi Arabia keeping the prices high, are they trying to drive out are they trying to bankrupt some of our oil producers?
So, we believe that, we believe that their goal, ultimately is they're testing at what price U.S. production will start to fall. And if you are OPEC, that's what you want to do. What we're trying to do is to try to present a balanced view of the market, right? You know, we can sit here and we can tell you this is exactly what's going on. But our view, if we were OPEC, when I say OPEC, I mean Saudi Arabia. If you are Saudi Arabia and you see your market share being eroded, your goal is to go on the offense. Which means, one, they have stockpiled, enormous amount of reserves over the last couple of years, when oil prices were high. So they have that cushion, that a lot of people aren't factoring in. People are saying OPEC has to respond. Specifically, Saudi Arabia. They don't. They don't have to respond right now. What they can do is they can sit and wait as prices continue to fall because they have a large reserve.
Of cash. So Saudi Arabia can handle it, but Iran can't handle it. Russia can't handle it. What point can we stop handling it where it starts to really hurt us?
So the U.S. market is far more complicated than people are making it. And everybody seems, for a headline, everybody wants to pull a number.
Yeah,
right?
I can imagine.
It's $40. It's big. So here's the thing. So the best way to understand it is to look at it this way. You have to say there's already wells that are drilled that are already producing. So the cost to keep those wells producing is marginal, right? So there's that number you have to factor in. So that's one. Two, what you also have is you have the ability for E&P companies to go to ask service companies for price reduction. People aren't looking at that. And then the third layer that you have to factor in is that some of these plays, based on where you are, the cost of your returns, if you will,
mm-hmm.
You know, in the industry they call it IRR, initial rate of return. Some of those are down to, you know, $50 a barrel, you know, EOG in the sweet spot of the Eagle Ford. So people are just looking for a number. You're just looking for a headline. What we say is the number is staggered. Wells that are already drilled that haven't been completed. If you look at the cost to complete an Eagle Ford, we'll just say Marcellus well.
So they're just going to hold back on investments until the number goes back up, but the ones that are already drilled, they're just going to keep plowing along, you think, because the cost is lower.
Yeah, and, you know, what we're seeing now, we saw this whole game played out before. People are forgetting that this game played out with natural gas.
In the late 86, right? In
1980? No, just a few years ago.
Years
ago, U.S. natural gas production went through the roof. What happened to natural gas price? Gas prices went from $14 per MCF to $8 and down to $6. And prices got a low.
I remember that, yes.
And what happened? Operators in Marcellus still kept drilling. Production in Marcellus rose. So we've seen this story before. We just keep forgetting that we already have a playbook. Oil is a little bit different just because oil is traded on the international market versus just domestically consumed gas. But we've seen the story played out.
Well, back in 1986, Saudi Arabia did this, and it really did work for them because a lot of the oil producers really did go bankrupt, and they claimed a much larger market share.
The market is much more dynamic now in the sense that you didn't have a dominant force like a China that just consumes a massive amount of crude. So those are the difference in the market.
So is the market just healthier? I mean, is this just a market at work and versus people being able to control it? People can't control it like they used to, and there's more competition and it's just healthier? Is that what is really going on?
That's what we believe. I mean, if you really wanted to narrow it down, what we believe is the fundamentals of the market have changed. The market is a lot better now in the sense that what you have is much more, you have less concentration of quote-unquote power, if you will. You know, prior to ramp-up of U.S. production, what the Saudis did would have definitely drove prices down a lot further, a lot quicker than we are seeing. But what we have in the international market, people are considering the growth of China. People are considering, here's a piece that we are forgetting. Low oil price, which means low gasoline price, helps Europe. Europe is in a total mess right now. So low gasoline prices right now helps Europe. So we have a much balanced system, healthier market, if you will.
So a lot of this is the downward pressure from Europe, you're thinking, too.
No, we're just, you know, what we're telling our clients, you know, because we have a consulting business as well, what we're telling our clients is that don't run for the hills, right? What we're saying is that the market is much more staggered now versus, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. Staggered in the sense that you know, these wild gyrations and fluctuations in prices 5 years ago would have swept up a lot of the market. What we're saying is we won't see that now. You will see downward pressure on pricing, and that won't go away. What we're seeing now maybe in the next 2 years, it will just be a figment of her imagination. We'll just forgot that we went through this short, sharp cycle.
Well,
but then you also have to forget.
Consumers like it.
It's good for consumers.
Consumers right? love it. And so do, you know, businesses that have fleets, you know, airlines, UPS, FedEx. I mean, there's a lot of fleet-based businesses.
So that's the interesting thing. The interesting thing And, you know, the one thing we don't have an handle on, and it's something that we'd love to understand, is when you look at the overall market itself, there's a large portion of the market that are, we call net consumers. So the net consumers of low prices. You just talked about, you know, the abundance of consumers. You talked about airlines. You talk about, all these, even oil companies themselves, too, some of their operations, right? You know, you've got mass, because people tend to forget that some of these play in terms, they're massive operations. So a low, it's just that too low of a price does affect cash flow for some of these companies.
Well, Saudi Arabia can't do this forever, right? And if we can handle it, then it, I mean, they're just losing money. I mean, in that way, kind of. If it's not going to affect their market share, then... So that's what you're thinking. They're just trying to figure out where that price point is.
Yeah, that's what we believe. We believe that because we're putting ourselves in their shoes as consultants, and we're saying we told a large bank the other day who was asking us some questions. We said to them, think about the business as you think about your own business. You know, if you as a bank provide investment banking services to 5 or 6 new companies that IPOs every year, and then you have a new bank that all of a sudden comes into the market, because that's what we have to consider shale oil as, right? It's a new, you've got a new ramp up of production. You've got a new bank that comes into the market. What happens? You start to lose market share. So that's how we try to get people to better understand why Saudi Arabia is making the move that they're making. And some people may ask, why are you just singling out Saudi Arabia? They're not the only players in OPEC. They're not, but they are the biggest.
They're the most powerful.
They're the most powerful.
Well, how is Iran doing? Because Iran, what I understand, a major part of their economy is oil, and they are dying on the vine right now with these prices.
So if you really wanted to play the geopolitical, we try to stay out of the geopolitical part of it a lot just because we're trying to look at market fundamentals. But if you play the geopolitical part, you could also say it's a great way for Saudi Arabia to remind its neighbors that we do wield power, right? So if you look at what's going on in Iraq and Iran, if they can drive prices down and keep prices down for a while, their neighbors are reminded of the enormous power that they control it from a geopolitical standpoint. So if you wanted to look at, if you wanted to bring that into.
Well, it's hard not to, right? Because with all the wars and the fighting and all the stuff that's going on, it's hard not to bring that into the equation because it is part of the equation. I would think it would have to. We don't operate in, yeah.
It is a major portion, but we, you know, when we're looking at what happens next, those are things we can control, right? So we do factor them into our study, but we also try to look at what's going on and keep that on the sideline, only because, for example, that environment could change tomorrow.
Yeah.
And the fundamentals of the market in terms of demand and consumption may not change, and we have to be able to adjust accordingly.
Well, so, how is Russia doing with these prices? How is it affecting them?
It's interesting because, you know, we hear all sorts of stuff. We had one client who said, this is great for, this temporary drop in prices is great for the U.S. in the sense that it helps to bend Russia's resolve, right? We can withstand a lot longer. We are much more diverse in terms of our economy. So that's one thing that we have heard. A large part of their economy is based on oil dollars. And we've tried everything to get them to change their ways, and nothing has worked. So what we see happening there is it's interesting because everybody is just, again, sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what happens. If prices go up, then, you know, the Russians are back to what they were doing before, not just the Russians, the Iranians.
Sure, yep.
So you could factor a drop in price as, again, a way for the Saudis to say, or the Saudis' reluctance to drop, to reduce their production. You could see that as a way for them to be forced in the hands of the Russians. Here's the one other piece that a lot of other people I don't hear talked about a lot. What I don't hear talked about a lot is the fact that typically when OPEC meets and they agree on a production reduction, what typically happens is because they don't trust each other. So
nobody trusts anybody.
Exactly. So when they say, look, we're going to cut production by, let's say, 1 million barrels, and then everybody looks at Saudi and says, well, you're producing the most. Why do you trust the most? So, you know, the Saudis could just be saying, look, we don't believe when other members say they will cut, so we won't cut until it becomes so painful that they have no choice but to cut when they agree on a cut. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And maybe they're just reasserting their, hey, you guys better tell us the truth because you've called, you know, we're calling a spade, and we want to make sure you play ball next time, honestly.
Exactly. Because you know what? Here's what would have happened. What would have happened is when they met on November 27th and they announced the cut, the market would have rallied. Prices would have, oil prices would have recovered. And what happened? Nothing, it would have meant nothing for the Russians. They'd go back to getting $85, $90 oil. It would mean nothing for the Iranians. They'd get $89 oil. It would encourage them to increase production. So the market.
Yeah, that makes sense. If they reduce production, all we're doing is encouraging everybody else to produce more. So we're not going to play that game anymore.
Exactly. So what we're constantly trying to do is to imagine ourselves in their position and say, so when people come to us, you know, and believe me, you know, huge banks that ask us that question. Everybody seems to want that. What price does U.S. production start to drop off? And, you know, our response typically is why is that important? That's the first thing, right? And then the next thing is, why haven't you looked at a staggered drop in production? And then the third thing we typically say, look at what happened to the gas market.
Well, and your staggered drop in production makes sense because the companies that are highly leveraged, they can't handle much of a drop. They're going to go first. The companies that are very solid and they can handle it aren't going to be dropping for a while. The companies that are investing a lot and their oil production isn't up, so they're not selling, are going to struggle unless they have a lot of cash reserve. It totally depends on your cash position and your debt position, right?
Yeah, but if we really focus on just the debt position, then 99% of these, the share drillers,
everybody goes out.
They're leveraged, right?
So Everybody's leveraged.
So that's why we believe. That's why we believe that.
That's why the banks are worried. Oh my God! That's why the banks are so worried. That's why you're so popular.
We're popular. We're popular because we aren't the kind of. But seriously, you know, our business has grown over the last couple of months.
Well, you have good information.
Exactly. And then the other thing, too, is we try to be as objective as we can. We don't, when people ask us, you know, what do we think, we try to provide as much raw data to support our points as much as we can versus just saying, hey, here's what we think. We're saying, here's what we're seeing.
And that's why they're hungry for it. And that's why I was saying you're so popular is because if the banks, if all these companies are so highly leveraged, these banks are – They're on the hook for this, so you're popular with them.
but we, you know, this is not, you know, we've seen this, like I said, seen this before. And you know, the question we ask internally constantly among ourselves is, you know, which we think is the $1 million question, and that is when you have a drop in production, if the Saudis hold out until that point. So you ask yourself, at what point does the Saudis say, okay, it's enough is enough, it's time for us to go back into the market? That's the first question we ask ourselves. Then we ask ourselves the follow-up question that says, okay, what are bankers thinking, capital providers specifically? And the third thing we ask ourselves is what effect this will have on the much broader market. So those are, you know, constant questions being asked. And then the data is constantly changing, right? You know, we look at production, and production still seems to be going up, which means, you know, this is the thing that's shocking.
Well, they're getting better at it, right? And more of the wells are coming online, so it's just going to keep going up unless they stop altogether. I'm sorry, go ahead. What's so shocking?
You know, what's shocking to us is if you just take pure market fundamentals, right? Take out everything else. Take pure market fundamentals. You've had a 30% drop in price, right?
Yeah.
But within that time frame, you haven't had a 30% growth in production. So you really have to ask yourself, what's driving that, right? And it's just a lot of it, we think, is financial players in the market, people covering shorts. That is a huge part.
Oh, that's exactly what's going on. That's probably right, because they're getting paid the rate that it was, you know, maybe at a much higher rate because they have derivatives on it.
Exactly. Because if you take fundamentals and say prices dropped 30%, production hasn't grown 30% in that time frame. So what has caused that sharp drop in such a short period of time?
Well, so are the Wall Street companies being affected? If they're paying out on all these derivatives.
Well, they are. I mean, a lot of these guys had positions, guys and gals had positions that they're now having to cover. You want to cover these positions now versus carrying them into 2015 and take the loss, be able to write, you know, there's tax benefits and so forth and so forth. So there's, you know, the market is so different now. It's, you know, people say, well, it's all about demand and consumption. We don't think it's just the demand and consumption. Because if that was the case, prices shouldn't have dropped.
Yeah, that's BS. I'm just saying it's BS. Me and my husband talk about it, and every time we hear someone say it's just about supply and demand, we're like, oh, yeah, right. Let's turn the channel or whatever we're watching. It's so obvious. Well, what about the petrodollar? What about the pact that we have in, you know, Saudi Arabia? Don't we have this pact with the petrodollar about protection of the OPEC countries?
Well, you know, here's the interesting, you know, there's been, that's an area that we specifically try to stay away from, only just because we don't understand what that means.
Yeah, because you're not in the meetings, right?
Yes. So
I'm not there.
It's sometimes not even meetings. Sometimes it's more to do with, you know, as you may understand, like we, from the political part of the business, we try to. You know, circumvent yourself from that part of business a lot, just because, again, you're not dealing with some of the variables that are changing because of market dynamics. For example, let's say we were forecasting China to grow 30% over the next 2 years, just roughly, right? Demand in terms of
demand,
food consumption, yes, and and prices drop. So the question there you ask yourself is, okay, what does that mean? It's not a geopolitical issue. It's fundamental. It's maybe the Chinese have, you know, over a year time frame, the Chinese have decided, hey, instead of moving more for poor people to cars, they're moving to bicycles.
Yeah, but when they're doing development, they're doing alternative energies too, right? They're doing solar and different things, that so their demand isn't necessarily going up as fast as we thought, even when they do grow. Is that accurate?
Well, there's been different schools of thoughts in the market. Some people have said because the world economy are slowing down, so naturally China is going to slow. That just makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah. Well, China's just China stayed flat. That's what I just read, is they stayed flat, and Europe's in a mess. And so we always thought that our growth in oil would be compensated by the growth around the world, and it's just not.
Exactly. But you know, we always say, if you are projected to grow and you are flat, then you have dropped. Some people say, oh, we've stayed flat. Well, no, you haven't. If you are projected to consume, let's just use rough numbers, you're projected to consume 1 million barrels a day, and you're consuming now $700,000 a day, then you haven't stayed flat. You see what I'm saying? So it's,
yeah.
when you look at world markets in terms of, again, purely based on consumption, then, you know, it's China has slowed. And a lot of models we've seen in terms of world growth for crude, a lot of China's growth was modeled into those demands.
So tell me again what you think, where you think Russia's at and how long they can handle this.
Well, the interesting thing is Russia has no say in what's going on now, right?
They're
a player that has to sit, and it's kind of an interesting thing because everybody says, oh, again, our position is very simple. People say, you know, the U.S. has now become the player that moves the production needle. Yes, production in the U.S. has grown, and you have to factor that in. But here's the one thing that's undisputable. What's undisputable is that November 27th, when OPEC met, and basically Saudi Arabia came out and said, we are not moving production. Look at, and you want clear evidence of who runs the market, the international market, look at what has happened to prices between then and now.
Yeah, they're asserting their power. But you think about,
go ahead.
I was going to say, think about Iran. I just did a show, it's airing right now, and we talked about how the United States with cyber tools, they had a tool that went into Iran's, they essentially shut down Iran's nuclear program through these, you know, different cyber espionage tools and things, and they came out and the government admitted to it. So now they're getting hit, they got hit by on one end with their energy, you know, their nuclear energy, and now they're getting hit on the other end with their oil. It's like they're getting hit on both sides.
They're
getting clobbered.
But it's interesting because, you know, a lot of geopolitical stuff
it's interesting. Let's face it.
It's very interesting.
I got to get somebody like you who has all these facts, and I got to talk about all these cool things because it's really interesting.
No, it is very interesting.
It's all theory because we're not in the room when they're making all these decisions behind closed doors.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't, and that's what we like are the things that we do know. And we speak to those things very well, right? A lot of the other things we don't know. We don't know how long their economy can hold on while prices, you know, Venezuela, take Venezuela as an example. They need prices to go up. When everybody else was banking petrodollars, they weren't. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, I found something that showed that the president of Venezuela is pressuring OPEC to try to get they'll keep pressuring OPEC until they cut production to the point where the prices get back to $100 a barrel. I mean, that's where they want it. That's high for the U.S., right? I mean, we don't want it that high. That's kind of at our top level.
It's interesting, right? We have clients that are E&P companies. We have clients that are service companies. And so here's, you know, our position is that market fundamentals is what should determine prices, right? That's what we honestly believe, that market fundamentals should determine what the price per barrel is. However, there's so many different things that are playing the market. So the fundamentals of the market is not what drives the market anymore. So you can tell yourself, okay, we need fundamentals to set price. At a certain price, it becomes, economies suffer, economies that depend on gasoline, a byproduct of crude. When the prices, especially if you look at even the U.S., when prices are high, and the word high is relative, right? Because high for us may mean $110, and a high for an E&P company that's extremely leveraged has debt payments coming up where their break-even price in a play that they're in is $95. They may tell you that high is $130. But yeah, the word high is relative.
They're not sleeping well.
But that's what I was trying to, what we're trying to establish sometimes when people say to us, the prices are too high. We typically say the word high is relative. It depends on who you ask.
High is never too high. If you're fully leveraged, high is never too high.
Exactly. If you ask a typical consumer, they'll tell you, we've had people tell us, right now who works in the oil business that says, look, right now I go to the pump and I don't feel bad. Like I like, and it's interesting because they're supported by the industry. So, the word high is relative. What we believe that the fundamentals should support price. $150 is just ridiculous. If we had to stake a number, we would stake a number between 85 and 95 is what we would stake. That's a number that we would pick.
And that's kind of the sweet spot for the United States, right?
It is. And, prices like those, what it allows us to be able to do, one thing I also want to say, people, when we talk about this energy independence, I really wanted to bring that up because there's this,
I wanted to talk about energy independence as well.
There's this huge, misinformation that goes, you have politicians that say, and sometimes these guys are very educated. It makes me wonder. They talk about energy independence and they talk about U.S. energy independence. So, what we tend to forget is that 3 million barrels per day comes from Canada. We should never forget that. So, for the U.S. to be energy independent, we need to displace 3 million barrels from around the world, and we need to produce another 3 million that comes from Canada. So we need to grow production by 6 million barrels.
Well, yeah, because if we do 9.1 and we've already compensated for 30%, we got to compensate for the other 70%.
So that's why the word, when we talk about energy independent, I would rather the conversation be about, and then the whole dynamics of the U.S. would have to change. Meaning, these shale plays, remember when I talked initially about light and heavy crude?
Yeah.
A lot of our refining capacity, a lot of the refineries are built to handle heavy. The U.S.
What is the difference between heavy and light?
It's the API gravity. It's, how easy it is to crack it.
Is light easier than heavy?
Light is, yes.
So we're producing some pretty good stuff right now.
We're producing light crude. So, but our imports from Canada, a lot of that imports that come from Canada is heavy crude.
And that's because they just ran out of the really sweet stuff, the really good
stuff?
No,
it's just the nature of what they produce. It's just the nature of the production. So the question becomes that we would have to find sources of oil production that's heavy production, right? Or we'd have to change, reconfigure tons and tons of refineries.
Oh, that makes sense. We really aren't sitting, our facilities just aren't set up for us to be energy independent for quite a while. I mean, we have a lot of infrastructure changes that needs to go on. And do we really want to totally change over everything to light sweet?
That's I really wanted to, I have a lot of friends in the financial industry that always, I hear them talk and I always try to remind them and correct them if they will, because they do hear people talk about it. And it's very nice things to say, but it's not the truth, right? When we talk about energy independence, what we should say is North American energy independence, not U.S.
Sure.
Energy independence. So I really wanted to kind of bring that out because I think it's very important. And then that one other point for you listeners that's very important is the connection between the price at the pump and, because people always hear oil price, and they get mixed up with gas, natural gas. So then someone says, well, how is natural gas price now lower, and I'm still paying? Natural gas is not what you pump at when you pull your car up, right? That's
yes.
gasoline, and that's actually refined from crude oil, not natural gas.
Yeah, people get confused.
I kind of find that out. People do get, even this morning I had someone say that to me, that, you know, I don't understand why natural gas is, you know, $3 and I'm paying this amount, you know, why, and I'm saying natural gas has nothing to do with what you pump when you pull your car.
It's just a totally different product that we do differently.
It's just completely
separate.
It's completely different. So that's, you know, those are the two very, very important points that people need to understand when they hear politicians talk about, you know, U.S. energy independence. Not in my lifetime is that possible.
Well, I do have a question. I've heard that Kenya is, and probably other countries as well, but Kenya is really working on geothermal energy with using fracking methods, and they're pumping water in there and heating the water and then using the steam to produce their energy. Have you heard about some of the alternate usages for fracking?
No, I, you know, we buried our head in the sand, if you will.
Well, this is new, so I mean, I was just wondering what you thought about some of that stuff, because it's bringing up, you know, whenever you get into new technologies, then there ends up being all these offshoots of it, and it's super new. But with this fracking they've learned and this geothermal, they have enough, because you can get down to the magma layer in Kenya without going too low, and I guess they have enough with the geothermal and heating the water, they have enough to enough energy sources to provide for their whole country without going too low, and it's not that, it's pretty cost effective. I thought that was interesting. A friend of mine just told me about it and wanted me to ask you and see if, and it was more just new technology magazine mm-hmm. headline stuff.
No, here's what I would say on that. What I would say is we're going through a time now where technology, the focus is now on technology.
Yes, I would agree with you. I'm sorry, go ahead. Just because I agree doesn't mean you should stop talking. I interrupt way more than I should.
No, I think it's great that companies now are really focused on technology. They have been in a long time, but there's even more so now. There's a lot of experiments being done, using different fracking technology. And the interesting thing there is that we're only going to get better, right?
Yes, exactly.
As these technologies get, as we understand them more, we understand how they work, we're only going to get better at using these technologies.
Well, how does
I think it's a great thing.
But how do the environmentalists factor into this? Because I know there's been a lot of stuff in the media about the environmentalists and their thoughts on fracking, or has that kind of died out lately?
You're always going to have, what we say is this, you're always going to have people against and for anything. It doesn't matter. Fracking is not the first technology for people to be against. You know, people were against, you know, people and still are against oil sand mining. And it's not just in oil and gas. I think sometimes we also forget that. That people have, you know, opposing views to anything you can think of. Some people like the financial industry, some people don't like the financial industry. You're always going to have those. The one thing I would say about fracking is, you know, I'm not a geologist by any means, but what I do understand is is that a lot of people who sometimes are anti-fracking, if they would just, and this is, again, if they would just spend the same amount of time they allocate to not understanding as they do to try to understand the technology, I think a part of the misconception is just education and fear. You know, people are, when you're against something, it's easy to herd people in a certain way. You know, I've got lots of friends that are environmentalists, and we go back and forth on fracking. And I always say that, you know, in any industry, you've got two things that happen. One, you do have accidents. And a friend of mine would say, well, why isn't the oil and gas industry, you know, stepping up and saying this? And, but they do. It's just, it's no different from brain surgery, right? You have doctors who will admit to an extent from a liability standpoint, right? So you also have to factor that in. Nobody talks about that. So it's no different. You know, you have accidents. Accidents happen all the time. But what we do know is that the technology has gotten tremendously better. What we do know is that if you were to, again, at basic level, this is a number I always tell people, at the basic level, if you just take one number, let's do a quick addition here. If we were spending $100 per barrel, let's just use that flat number because it's easy.
Sure.
If we were, if 5 years ago we were importing 9 million barrels per day, and now we are importing 6.5 million barrels per day. If you just do the simple math and say we're going to use a flat line decline and say from then to now, we have displaced 2.5 million barrels per day. 2.5 million barrels per day times $100. Do the math and see how much money has been brought back into the U.S. economy as a result of growth in production.
Oh, so, yeah. From an economic standpoint, it's a no-brainer. Well, and some people, what I've been reading is that some people think that's what's going to pull the United States out of our long-term recession. I mean, people say we're not in the, you know, the economists technically say we're not in the recession, but the people on the street feel it. And what, you know, the bright spot is this whole energy sector, the oil sector is going to pull us out of that long-term recession. I think there's other things we can do too that could pull us out, but as far as the most practical thing, it's this industry.
Yeah, we tend to forget. And again, if you just use flat numbers, you know, those are things that people who weren't working before, who are now working as a result of new jobs being created and so forth, they tend to ignore those numbers. But those numbers are real. If you used to import 9 million, we're now importing 6.5 million. We've displaced. Yeah. 2.5 million, and that's just a fact.
And like you said, you focus on the numbers, you don't get into the politics of it, so, and you have a lot of friends who are environmentalists, so it's just the facts.
Yeah, it's easy to get lost in the emotional parts of discussion sometimes, specifically as it pertains to, you know, oil, gas, you know, religion, if you will, you know, geopolitics, you know, because we're a data-driven company, we try to just look at the raw data and say, okay, what is the data telling us? It's telling us that these are the things that are the market forces currently, and that's what we focus on, because that's what our customers are.
Sure,
are,
that makes sense.
Know, needing as well, too.
So how can people get hold of you?
So we are at, it's easy, we are at shaleexperts.com, and, you know, we're always, one of the great things about what we do here is we are, you know, we're always open to ideas, and we've done a gamut of different projects. We've done projects on, water consumption, in the industry. We've done projects on forecasting. But our sweet spot is the unconventional plays and what effect from a macro standpoint as well as from nuts and bolts. We even have people who are, like, you know, they provide, and this is going to sound really interesting, but they provide porta potties for the oil and gas space. And so they come to us and they're trying to find out, how can we get business? So go to shaleexperts.com.
That's funny. It's, anybody, yeah.
Yeah, so if you work in the energy space, you're a service company, or you're trying to get into, you have helped small companies get into the space as well, you just go to shaleexperts.com and we're right there.
And there's a lot of new players that are getting in and getting into this industry. And you'd be a perfect person to talk to for them as well, wouldn't you?
Yeah, we help a lot of new companies who are trying to understand, how to get in. And even companies that are already established who are also trying to figure out from a strategic standpoint, where do we grow? What's next? So it's been fun. Exciting and tiring, and it's been very, very interesting and rewarding too. If you want to find us, shaleexperts.com, or you can call us at 713-775-8370.
Okay, so shaleexperts.com, and you're going to send me that number and that website, which I already know the website, shaleexperts.com, and I'll have that up on the radio page as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Ron. You have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, that was an interesting interview. I just always have a hard time believing that the oil industry is affected by supply and demand. Like they always say, it's more demand or it's less supply or whatever. I just don't believe it ever when I see that on the news. I always think it's some kind of geopolitical situation. But you know what? This time around, there really is a supply issue. But, the supply issue could be artificially created by Saudi Arabia. Who knows? Well, we know it's artificially created by Saudi Arabia, but the question is why? And is the U.S. behind that? And, the answers we will never really know, but at least we got a good insight into what the possible reasons why they could be doing it, and also the market conditions and why. What's going on in the market? It would be so nice if the oil industry could get to a point where it's just based on free market conditions. I don't know if it ever will be, because oil is so important for countries. It's a resource that it's a scarce resource in the sense that we all need it so badly. I mean, we all need it to get to work. It affects us at the pump. It heats our house. It's really important for everybody. So it's a very interesting, important issue. But that's all I have today. I hope you have a wonderful day.